Hey, and welcome to Stop the Presses. Your host, Mark Anderson, coming to you live, finally, 2nd of December, 2019. And as announced, we're continuing an exploration with my co-host, Johnny Delirious. And we have been tracing the origins and getting into the content of Dr. Richard L. Day's rather mysterious and prophetic speech that took place in March of 1969, and it outlines a totalitarian agenda that this one-time director of Planned Parenthood was laying out at the time. I'm reading some messages here. We'll be listening to some excerpts of Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan's recollections of Dr. Day's prophetic and totalitarian speech in just a moment. There are some three or four installments of Dunnigan's audio recollections. And I may ask if we can play the tail end of number two before we play number three. At any rate, I have the script here, the transcript as well, so I can read what we don't listen to directly, ladies and gentlemen, listening live and on the archive. And what happened in recent times was Johnny and I did this show live and outlined the first two parts of it. And then I reran a rebroadcast parts one and two after we did them live to make sure we laid, a firm foundation for this and as a way to get through the holiday weekend as well. So, Johnny, first of all, let me say hello to you.
Thank you, Mark. Glad to be here.
Yeah, I'm getting my thoughts together. I had one of those mornings, overslept, went out, thought I'd take care of a simple errand. Simple errand became huge errand. Hadn't eaten. Got food in starvation mode, drove food home, ate food, just got done chomping, did radio show.
Sounds like a good life.
Yeah, one shoe on, one shoe off, one car door open, one car door shut, going backwards down the highway at 90, one of those days.
Wow.
We've all had them, and maybe I'm exaggerating just slightly. At any rate, let's listen to about the last 5 minutes, if possible, of number two. I'll ask the board ops if she could put it at about the last 5 minutes. Whatever the full length is, just back it up maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes. And we'll do that in just a moment. But, Johnny, I really appreciate you helping me outline this. We are listening to, after all, someone who was a medical doctor. Dr. Richard L. Day, that gave this prophetic totalitarian speech, passed away in 1989, 20 years after he gave this March 1969 speech. And what you and I have been amazed at is just how prophetic it is. Either things were already in motion, rapid, totally revolutionary social, cultural, political, and economic changes, either they were already in the offing just a little, or they were dead ahead 3, 5, 7, 10 years. And it's come true across the board. And you might recall we talked about something even as innocuous sounding as making street signs completely confusing. Well, I just discovered that Highway 495 here in South Texas, I thought it had two names. It has three.
Wow. Yeah.
It's Ferguson Road, and then if you go further west, it's Pecan. Like a nut, like a pecan. So if you're going from west to east, it's Pecan, Ferguson, and then it just becomes 495. But it's 495 all along.
Right.
So, in fact, one day I drove up to it, and I looked at Angie. I said, well, this isn't 495. This is Pecan. And then I drove about another 10 feet and looked at the signs again, and I realized Pecan and 495 were one and the same. I never knew that.
Yeah, it's interesting throughout this whole spectrum, you know, your health, the confusion outlay that's been put out and put into place all along the way in all these different aspects of the full spectrum that they're laying out the agenda. They have your hand on your wallet all the way through from cradle to the grave.
Oh, absolutely. And we'll be listening to about the last 7 minutes of tape two, the audio, so we get enough flow and continuity when we get into three. Because number three is actually a recording of someone interviewing Dr. Dunnigan, who's the one, again, who recollected what Richard Alday said. But yeah, you're right, Johnny. It's they're milking you for your funds the whole time. And I think that explains what modern debt slavery is. It basically means that each person is marked as being liable for the national debt, and that most of their labor, a good portion of it, is already weighted or pre-configured to
you're exhaling carbon dioxide, so we got to tax you for that. You confuse about the street signs, so you need psychological help for that. You need to pay for drugs for that. And just all down the way, it's like you can't get away from it. They're trying to just milk you all the way through and have you die an early death.
Yeah, I believe that that's basically what it boils down to. And even if you don't happen to die an early death, you will have dedicated a big bulk of your labor, thoughts, energy, time, et cetera, and money to other people's wealth, to building the wealth of others, to expanding the vistas and horizons for a tiny, tiny minority of human beings. 1% of the 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 1%. Some people say as few as 5 or 10,000 human beings control everything in the world, that it could be no more than the population of a small town.
Yeah, and it's all based on lies, Mark. I mean, the carbon, excess carbon, is good for the trees. It's good for the jungle. It helps create more life.
It in fact, is the gas of life. It has been called that.
Yes. And now they're telling us that it's horrible for our planet. Ha! What a joke.
Yeah, they're even making full-size posters. Remember, like they used to make full-size posters of communist leaders, Che Guevara, Fidel Castro, big murals. Yeah. Cult of personality. Now they're doing it for Greta Thunberg, the clueless little Pippi Longstocking of climate change. They're doing big facial murals, full size, you know, like huge murals that are, you know, like 30 by 40 feet. And so they've adopted her as the new leader of this cult of personality. Mm-hmm. But with these prefacing and warming up remarks that we're making, now let's get into about the last 5 to 7 minutes of Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan's recollections from tape number two. We'll segue that into number three as best we can in the time provided. So let's go ahead with that now.
Then these homes could be taken by increased taxes or other regulations that would be detrimental to home ownership and would be acceptable to the majority. Ultimately, people would be assigned where they would live, and it would be common to have non-family members living with you. Just by way of your not knowing just how far you could trust anybody. This would all be under the control of a central housing authority. Have this in mind in 1990 when the census comes out and they ask how many bedrooms in your house, how many bathrooms in your house, do you have a finished game room? This information really is personal and of no national interest to government under our existing constitution. But you'll be asked those questions and decide how you want to respond to them. When the new system takes over, people will be expected to sign allegiance to it, indicating they don't have any reservations or holding back to the old system. There just won't be any room, he said, for people who won't go along. We can't have such people cluttering up the place, so such people would be taken to special places. And here I don't remember the exact words, but the inference I drew was that at these special places where they were taken, then they would not live very long. He may have said something like disposed of humanely, but I don't remember very precisely, just the impression that the system was not going to support them when they would not go along with the system. That would leave death as the only alternative. Somewhere in this vein, he said, there would not be any martyrs. When I first heard that, I thought he meant that people would not be killed, but as the presentation developed, what he meant was they would not be killed in such a way or disposed of in such a way that they could serve as inspiration to other people the way martyrs do. Rather, he said something like this, people will just disappear. Just a few additional items sort of thrown in here at the end, which I feel to include where they belong more appropriately. One, the bringing in of a new system, he said, probably would occur on a weekend in the winter. Everything would shut down on Friday evening, and Monday morning when everybody wakened, there would be an announcement made that the new system was in place.
Let's cut in right there. Johnny,
yeah.
This is some of the most chilling things that we've heard so far in this exploration. Now, we can say fairly confidently that things haven't gotten quite that 1984, where, you know, the census is not just for innocuous nomenclature and information, but is much more prying, and the information is used in a much more detrimental and warfare-like way, where people that don't go along with the new housing and living arrangements would just simply be eliminated.
Well,
but,
or they'll just simply disappear.
Right.
That's what struck me, and I'll comment on that more in a minute when you're ready.
Well, let me get you there. Let me get you to comment there. Maybe we're seeing the beginning of it when we go through the border checkpoints when I go from Mexico back to the U.S. here in South Texas, or on the side of milk cartons or in other areas, post offices, wherever it might be, where we see all these missing children.
Mm-hmm.
And are we really to believe that all these missing children are purely and exclusively just kids that ran away, wouldn't come back because they didn't want to come back, or were randomly kidnapped or stolen away by either disgruntled or alienated ex-parents or ex-step-parents, or kidnapped by strangers, you know, perverts, pedophiles, whatever? Are we to believe that all of that disappearance is simply random crime, the kind that's portrayed on television? Or is that the beginning of testing our ability to discern this, where they make us believe that all these kids are just disappearing more or less due to family battles and custody battles and pissed off parents that didn't like the custody arrangements, step parents that went awry, or just perverts and, you know, miscellaneous criminals, or is this a way of getting that disappearance thing going? And then by the time it starts happening for real, we've already been softened up a bit. And that's pure speculation, but your thoughts on that?
Well, that's exactly a really good point. And kids are just one sector of who's disappearing. And they're definitely disappearing. And I think they're being kidnapped and being used. And if they can't be used for slavery and sexual slavery, then they're used for organ donation and things like that. But there's other disappearances that even the alternative media hasn't really reported on. And that is of people who are disappearing from going on these hikes and these camping trips, you know, out in Yosemite and all these open spaces. It's literally over 5,000 in the past, two or three years, or maybe, you know, 6 years, but it's over 5,000 of, and these are adventuresome people, you know, people that hike, that camp, they mountain climb, and they've been disappearing. And there's been reports about that in Arizona and Colorado and, you know, Nevada and things, places like that. But you don't hear about it. It's, boy, they don't talk about that. But when you talk about 5,000 hikers that have disappeared over a 6-year period, that's quite a bit. I mean, where do they go? Nobody seems to know. They put out search and rescue helicopters and they can't be found.
Back up, Johnny. Did you say 5,000 in a 6-year period?
Yeah, it's over 5,000, and it's at least a 6-year to six or seven-year period. I know from, they're saying 2014, you know, and that's where some of these stories are coming from. But each year, it seems like another few hundred disappear on these hiking trips and Yellowstone Park and all.
That's curious because these would be highly resourceful,
right,
self-reliant people skilled in the arts of survival, long-term travel with minimal resources.
The kind of people the globalists don't want.
Well, see, this is very interesting. Now, granted, we're speculating. Granted, we don't have a smoking gun here. But the numbers are very compelling because high numbers like that of competent people in the primes of their lives disappearing like that, evidently without a trace, and I need to look up more information on it. I'm the first to say I need to do more research here. But that is a huge red flag calling for much more inquiry.
Well,
and we'll leave it at that for now.
Yeah, it's easy to find. Just you know, Google search disappearing hikers, mountain climbers, something like that, and you'll pull it up.
Very interesting. Let's listen to about the last 3 minutes now of a section of tape 2, Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan recalling, again, the prophetic tyrannical words of Dr. Richard L. Day, and this is under the subhead in the transcript, The Arrival of the Totalitarian Global System. Here we go with about the last 3 minutes. We'll get maybe about the full 3 minutes in, and then we'll comment till the bottom of the hour. Okay, let's go with that.
The United States ready for these changes. He commented, everybody would be busier with less leisure time and less opportunity for people to really look about and see what was going on around them. Also, there would be more changes, more difficult to keep up as far as one's investments. Investment instruments would be changing, policies, interest rates changing, so that it would be a difficult job just to keep up with what you had already earned. Interesting about automobiles, it would look as though there were many, many varieties of automobiles, but when you looked very closely, there would be great duplication. It would be made to look different with chrome and wheel covers and this sort of thing, but looking closely, one would see that the same automobile was made by more than one manufacturer. This recently was brought home to me when I was in a parking lot and saw a small Ford, I forget the model, and a small Japanese automobile, which were identical, except for little things like the number of holes in the wheel cover and the chrome around the plate and the shape of the grill. But if you looked at the basic parts of the automobiles, they were identical.
Cutting in very briefly, all the mid-size SUVs that are out there now, the GMC Terrain, the Santa Fe, I think it's a Hyundai, they all look like variations on a theme. They all look virtually the same. There's not a total uniformity. There's some appreciable variety out there, but there seems to be a pretty big convergence of that mid-size SUV, isn't quite a car, isn't quite a minivan kind of vehicle out there. Let's keep going now.
Where I was struck with this, and I was again reminded of what had been said many years ago. I'm hurrying here because I'm near the end of the tape, and let me just summarize by saying, to hear all of these things said by one individual at one time in one place relating to so many different human endeavors, and then to look and see how many of these actually came about, that is, changes accomplished between then and now, and the things which are planned for the future, I think there's no denying that this is controlled, and there is indeed a conspiracy. The question then becomes what to do, and I think first off we must put our faith in God and pray and ask for his guidance. And secondly, I think do what we can to inform other individuals as much as possible, as much as they may be interested. Some people just don't care because they're preoccupied with getting along in their own personal endeavors. But as much as possible, I think we should try to inform other people who may be interested. And again, put our faith and trust in God and pray constantly for his guidance and for the courage to accept what we may be facing in the near future. Rather than accept peace and justice, which we hear so much now, it's a cliche, let's insist on liberty and justice for all.
And so I'll concludes tape two. Yeah, so concludes tape two of Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan's recollections of what Richard L. Day prophetically and tyrannically told that pediatric group in Pittsburgh in March of 1969. Again, Richard Day died in 1989, 20 years ago. And so what Dunnigan was talking about here when he recorded this evidently was in between 1969 and 1989. Either Dr. Day had just passed away or he hadn't quite passed away yet. I can't quite pin that down, but it was between those 2 years. And we also didn't listen to a couple other short segments of number two. Another subtitle in there was Home Ownership, a Thing of the Past. And another before that was Surveillance, Implants, and Televisions That Watch You. Now imagine going back to the long before the flat screen TVs and cable TV in its infancy, if that, Johnny. Imagine Dr. Dunnigan talking about that, but much less Dr. Day in 1969, because all Dunnigan is doing is recollecting things. But 1969, apparently, reportedly, Dr. Day was already talking about televisions that watch you. And that is just now, over the last couple of years, coming to the fore. So you want to talk about prophetic right there.
Yep. Yeah, that's back in the old tube sets. And so I heard, and it was just a rumor, that there's a way that the old tube sets could watch you. And that's why it took so long. When you turn it off, it still would glow. You know, it'd still be on and things like that. But I never did accept it. But I, me and my crowd, you know, growing up in high school, we ignored the TV. We would go surfing and just say, oh, we're not into the box. So we wouldn't really, you know, be a part of the TV culture. Although the people that we were around that were, they all seemed a little bit different. We called them squares. So it's interesting, you know, we were just relating to nature and the waves and going surfing and music and everything like that. But everybody else seemed to be part of the programming.
Yeah, exactly. And so it seems like TV then was an early attempt at what Alexa is now. They wanted some sort of Trojan horse device in the house that would be accepted because it would provide entertainment and it would help keep the kids corralled if they couldn't settle down, to, you know, get them watching TV and they'd settle down and the parents could think straight, kind of a electronic babysitter. Mm-hmm. And that's obviously true. That's true more now than ever. But it seems to me that the television, whose origins, take note, the origins of the television, the very etymology or origins of the television are extremely mysterious. You think telephone, Alexander Graham Bell. You think phonograph, Thomas Edison. You think light bulb, AC, DC current. There's Nikola Tesla and Edison are mixed in there. Marconi and Edison, Marconi and Tesla radio. But when you come to TV and you think, okay, who invented the TV? The mind goes blank. You want to know who invented the TV, Johnny? Nobody knows.
Yeah, I know the Germans had it during the war because they had guided bombs with television cameras on their bombs, and they had the old little joystick, the bombardier, and he'd guide the bombs based on the TV camera on the bomb, and he'd find and guide the bomb with the little fins to hit that factory or whatever they're bombing. So they were using it in World War II, the German Nazi bombardier. So I know that for a fact, but they had it before that, and they had it in the West as well as over in Europe.
Yeah, and it's interesting to note, we're getting out toward the bottom of the hour. We'll play audio part three after the bottom of the hour, so there's less interruptions and not such a choppy presentation. It's interesting to note, too, that William S. Paley, the founder of CBS, which was the very first overseer of CBS when it first came to the television airwaves, and David Sarnoff, the RCA GE guy, I forget the exact corporate interlock, that became NBC,
mm-hmm.
they were both out of military intelligence.
Yep.
And those were the top two. ABC, I'm not quite as clear on. I need to look it up. But NBC and CBS, William S. Paley for CBS, David Sarnoff for NBC, were right out of military intelligence. And it's pretty clear, it's becoming clear, that television was invented specifically as a early Alexa Trojan horse device to be put into the house to earn this special place in our lives. And then if it wasn't that way to begin with, and we don't know what the tube television would have done, it must have been pretty limited, and I don't think there was much real worry there. But the key thing was to have it in place.
Yeah.
So the device could evolve into more and more sophisticated models and then end up with what we have today. And now, if you've bought a flat-screen TV probably within the last 3 years to be safe, maybe 2 years to be ultra-safe, it probably has, depending on the adjustability of it, and depending on the exact nature of the system, but it probably, at least potentially, could be a two-way monitor where you would watch it, but it would also, or could also, watch you, depending on what was done on the other end of the spectrum, if someone wanted to watch you, if they had a reason to. I imagine it would be something that could be turned off and on, and they would only watch a specific person if they felt they needed to. They couldn't watch everybody at the same time. That's logistically impossible. So, but the capability is there, and so it seems like also with the programming, and James Perloff has noted this among other authors, that with the programming of television, they had fairly wholesome TV at first. You know, Leave It to Beaver, The Rifleman, Gunsmoke, Rawhide, you know, men presented in masculine ways, women presented in feminine ways. A pretty clean, straightforward social order was portrayed on television. But according to Perloff and others, the idea of that was, so TV would be accepted. If people saw good moral messages and good examples, they wouldn't object to the television medium itself. So then, once the TV was in, once it was ensconced in our society and everybody accepted it as a vital home item, then the programming slowly evolved toward being more destructive and subversive once that, you know, millions of TVs were in all these homes. And so we got about a minute or two before the break. Your comments on that?
Well, don't forget about the TV trays. That was a big deal back in the late 60s and early 70s. They were selling TV trays so you could watch TV while you're having your dinner. And let's also not forget, you know, CBS's logo, the all-seeing eye, just like it's right off that pyramid on the dollar bill, you know, that's their logo, that eye, you know. So it's almost like, you know, 1984, we're watching you.
Yes, yes. And there's also allegations. There's some pretty convincing videotapes on YouTube that the early national anthems that they used to sign off on when television would go off for the evening, don't we wish we had that again, that there was a message behind the message. And we'll talk about that a little bit later here after the break. So we'll be right back after these messages.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited. So take a breath, head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.
Corporate media dominates the American opinion. Finding independent voices that counter this avalanche is becoming increasingly difficult. With the endless corruption running rampant throughout our government, independent voices are needed more than ever to battle the offensive against our freedoms and liberties. As a listener of RBN, no one understands this concept better than you. Now it's up to you to do your part. The time has come for you to take action and begin broadcasting the truth to hundreds or thousands of people every month. Sound impossible? Quite the contrary. With pointed slogans from LibertyStickers.com, you can reach countless sleeping Americans unaware that they live in a real-life wonderland. LibertyStickers.com has a huge inventory of political bumper stickers and messages that reflect the truth about our government, our politicians, and the future of America. With so many in stock, there's one perfect for you. Visit us today at LibertyStickers.com. Again, that's LibertyStickers.com. Do your part. Your voice is important. Let it be heard.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Stop the presses. The 2nd of December. Could it be December 2019? Hey, my birthday's in 4 days. I'll be turning 59. I'll be right up front about it. The last time my age will have a 5 as the first number. One more year of that. At any rate, we now, in a couple minutes here or less, will be listening to one Randy Engel, E-N-G-E-L, interview Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan about his recollections about Dr. Richard L. Day. And let's just get right to that. I'll withhold comment. This gives a little more background on where and when Richard L. Day's speech took place and a little bit of the factual background about all the information we've heard. So let's go with that. Tape 3, here we go.
This is prepared in the final tape on the New Order of Barbarians. This interview by Randy Engel, director of the U.S. Coalition for Life, with Dr. Larry Dunnigan, was taped on October 10, 1991, in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. So I think why don't we open up with a little bit about the man whom you are talking about on these tapes, just a little profile and a little bit about his education, and particularly his relationship with the population control establishment. I think that probably was his entree into much of this information.
Dr. Day was the chairman of the Department of Pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh from about 1959 through 64, about that period of time. And then he left the University of Pittsburgh and went to fill the position of medical director of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America.
Mm-hmm. And he was about 1965 to 68, about that period?
Yeah, that'd be about the time, 64, 65 to about 68 or 69.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left there. I don't know specifically why. I did not know him intimately. We were, you know, more than acquainted. I was a student, and he would seek lectures. And so he knew my name as a student, and probably corrected some of my test scores and that sort of thing. Of course, I knew him as a lecturer who would stand in front of the auditorium and would, you know, listen as he talked about diseases.
And take notes as students?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, take notes.
Okay, so what's interesting, this man is not as well known, I think, to our listeners, like names like Mary Calderone, Alan Guttmacher. They were both medical directors at one time or other for Planned Parenthood. But Dr. Day was not well known, and as a matter of fact, when I went back into the CGIS archives, there was very, very little information that had his actual name on it. So he was not one of the better known of the medical directors, but I'd say he probably had the scoop on what was going on as well, if not better, than any of the others before or after he came. What was he doing? I mean, can you describe the scene of this particular lecture, the approximate date, and what was the occasion, and then a little bit about the audience?
This was the Pittsburgh Pediatric Society holds about 4 meetings each year where we have some speaker come in and talk about a medical topic related to pediatrics. And this was our spring meeting. It's always late February or part of March. This was in March of 1969. And it was held at a restaurant called Lamont, which is
well known in Pittsburgh.
Yeah. A beautiful place. It overlooks the confluence of the Ohio, where the Ohio River forms here, with the confluence of the Allegheny and the Ohio River. Very, very pretty place. And the tenants, I would say somewhere in the neighborhood of 80 people.
Mostly physicians?
Mostly physicians, if not exclusively physicians. Predominantly pediatricians, but there would be pediatric surgeons and pediatric radiologists, other people who were involved in medical care of children, even though they might not be pediatricians as such.
And the speech was given after a meal, I presume a nice meal, and everyone was settled down and
quite comfortable
and quite filled and really an ideal state to absorb what was ever coming. I think that when you're listening to the tape and he says some of the most, well, not only outrageous things, but also things that you would think a pediatrician would kind of almost jump off out of his seat up. For example, on the tapes when he mentioned the cancer cures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there were probably doctors in the audience who had children perhaps with a, treating a child or knowing of a child who was in need of a particular cancer cure. And to hear that they were sitting, some of these prescriptions for or treatments for cancer were sitting over at the Rockefeller Institute. And yet, as far as I got from the tape, everyone just kind of sat there, didn't say very much. I mean, he's talking about falsifying scientific data, and everyone just kind of yawns. And how long did the speech go on?
2 hours. See, he spoke for over 2 hours, which was longer than most of our speakers go. And one of the interesting things, as he finished and it was getting late, he said that there's much, much more, but we could be here all night, but it's time to stop. And I think that's significant, that there was much more that we never heard. In the beginning of the presentation, I don't know whether I mentioned this on the at the introduction of the first tape or not, but somewhere in the beginning of this, he said, "You will forget most or much of what I'm going to tell you tonight." And at the time, I thought, well, sure, that's true. We tend to forget. You know, somebody talks about it, you can forget a lot of what they say. But there is such a thing as the power of suggestion. And I can't say for sure, but I do wonder if this may not have been a suggestion when we were all full of a nice dinner and relaxed and listening.
End of an evening?
We took that suggestion and forgot, because I know a number of my colleagues who were there when I would, some years later, say, "Do you remember when Dr. Day said this, or he said that, or he said the other?" And I'd say, "Well, yeah, I kind of, is that what he said? Yeah, I kind of remember that." But most were not very impressed, which to me was surprising because, well, he used the example of cancer cures, but he said a number of things that...
like doctors making too much money and,
yeah,
you know,
changing...
Let's cut in there. I'm going to interject there. Johnny, that's a fairly matter-of-fact exchange, and evidently this is a Brandy angle. I think the transcript calling that interviewer Randy Engel, I believe, might be a typo. It's obviously a woman, unless she has a unusual name, like, you know, sometimes women take on a more mannish-sounding name. But what do you think of that? Now, there does seem to be a problem in my mind a little bit. If you go out there at a restaurant, obviously they had probably a private section of the restaurant where they have, you know, larger events and things like that, maybe receptions, whatnot. It seems to me that if you're a pediatrician and you're speaking to 80 run-of-the-mill, you know, everyday doctors, and you're going to bring up topics like this, it seems, number one, highly incongruent, and number two, highly risky of exposure. So, and again, I'm not really doubting the authenticity of what we've been talking about, but I got to keep my objectivity. In your mind, why would Dr. Day spring something so heavy for over 2 hours on these unsuspecting fellow doctors and take the risk that they just got done being told exactly how the world's going to be molded? And my gosh, I've got to go tell somebody. I've got to go tell a newspaper editor. I got to go tell the police. I got to go tell my mother. Why would Dr. Day take that risk? And is it plausible that he could say, you're going to forget most of what you hear tonight? And would that power of suggestion, just by making that offhand remark, could that really be enough to get people to largely consign what they've heard to the memory hole?
Well, they're not going to take it serious enough, like, as you say, to go out to the newspaper. They're just going to listen and sit there and not object. But he's still planting that seed, so they're ready. Just like, that's what I feel so much advertising and programming that's going on today. They're planting a seed to, you know, like Pavlov's dog, to entrain them to accept this new level of tyranny. And I think that's why Dr. Day just went through the whole gamut. Most of them, you know, it was just over their head, because after a while, you know, you just get overwhelmed. But he said it all, and some people would get some things and some people would get other things. And so when they compare notes later, you know, it's like, well, I don't remember that. And, you know, somebody else says, well, did you hear him say that? So then there's this confusion. So in the end of the day, he, you know, he's protected, but he's planted the seed so they can accept their new agenda.
Well, I will add that I did read that no one was allowed to record his speech. And that, if that's true, that's telling, because a recording would enable people not only obviously to refresh their memories, but to get past that kind of mesmerizing effect that a live speaker can have. When you listen to a live speaker, and if you focus on the personality, the look, the hand gestures — Barack Obama was studied in this — you can get kind of lost in the presentation and the
personality, you know.
Yeah, and that overtakes the message, and plus that little bit of suggestion that you'll largely forget what you're going to hear anyway. And so maybe that's it. Maybe it was so beyond the pale, so beyond the normal curve of what these doctors who are specialists are used to hearing, that it largely went over their heads. And those few that did get it and maybe had a furrowed brow had no recording that they could go back to. So maybe then this group of physicians was just a bunch of lab rats to Dr. Day, and a test case, if you will, a trial balloon.
Well, absolutely, because you got to practice. You know, you got to get it down. You got to make sure you have the agenda correct. And the only way you can do that is keep talking and keep telling. You know, they say, you know, unless you teach something, you really don't know it. So that was his first attempt to teaching the ideal audience, and that is the pediatricians themselves. They're the ones dealing with kids, so he's trying to get them to accept that, you know, saving every kid is not the most important thing.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing for a thing, for a doctor to hear, if you're an honest doctor at the time and you believe in actually curing people. And at this point, let's just listen to as much as we can within reason of this continuing dialogue in tape number three, the last of the three tapes. Let's just continue right there.
You're just going to be a high-paid technician rather than a professional who exercises independent judgment on behalf of his independent patient. Mm-hmm. A number of things I thought that should have been offensive and elicited a reaction from physicians because they are physicians.
Mm-hmm.
I was surprised at how little reaction there was to it. And then other things that I would have expected people to react to just because they were human beings. And I think most of the people at the meeting subscribe more or less to the Judeo-Christian ethic and codes of behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that was violated right and left. And particularly one of my friends who I thought would be as disturbed as I was about this just sort of smiled. Wasn't disturbed at all. And I thought, gee, this is surprising.
Was part of it also because of his prominence? I mean, he was
the authority figure. Yeah, I think there may be something to there. This is the authority we owe some deference here.
I mean, he couldn't possibly mean what he's saying, or there couldn't possibly be any. He's such a good guy. I've often heard that phrase. He's such a good guy. I can't believe that he'd actually.
I can only speculate about this, but I do think at the time there was an element of disbelief about all of this, thinking, oh, this is somebody's fairy tale plan, but it will never really happen because it's too outlandish.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we know step by step it is indeed happening right under our feet.
Yeah. Before talking about the specific areas, I think there's a lot of benefits from this tape. One of them is when we have a good idea of what the opposition is about and the techniques he's using, then you can turn around and begin your resistance to all the types of manipulation and so forth. So I think that the one of the ways I'd like to start off here is to talk about seeing that there were four or five theme songs that he kept on repeating them over and over again. For example, this business, which I think is so important, that people fail to distinguish between the ostensible reason and the real reason. In other words, if you want someone to do something and you know that initially he'll be balky at doing that because it's against his morals or against his religious beliefs, you have to substitute another reason that will be acceptable.
Yes.
And then after he accepts it and it's a fait accompli, then there's just no turning back.
Right.
I'll cut in right there very briefly. Johnny, one great example of what the interviewer talking to Lawrence Dunnigan said there, this real reason versus the ostensible reason. The big one, of course, is abortion. Abortion, we were told that we had to get rid of back alley abortions because women would get an abortion anyway, so we might as well make them legal. And then they brought in Betty Friedan and Gloria Steinem's feminism views and kind of integrated it in there and said, well, it's a woman's right to choose. And of course, in the choice movement, the pro-choice movement, they actually mean only one choice, and that is to kill the child. It's interesting that they can say the word choice but not have two options.
Right.
Which is that's like saying, would you like a can of Coca-Cola or a can of Coca-Cola? And you respond, well, they're both the same. There's no choice. That's the pro-choice movement's definition of choice. So they completely destroyed the choice concept. And so they tell women and they tell society all these things when the real reason is simply to cut the human population, to cull the herd.
Well, that's exactly the reason, and it's a mass extermination program from so many different levels. whether it's the drugs or the poisons or the toxins or actual killing of babies.
Yeah, because when you kill a child, you're killing everyone that would come after that child in that bloodline.
Yep.
And you're making the mother and in essence, the doctor, accomplices in the crime. And yes, it is a crime. And that is what makes the abortion industry, this for-profit racketeering industry, the, in my opinion, the largest crime wave, in human history. It's taken more toll than any wars, than anybody's Holocaust, big H or small H. It's killed more people, and it's the only way that you can devise the murdering of people and the elimination of their bloodlines while making other people who are alive, mothers and doctors, and in a way fathers who acquiesce, making all of them accomplices in the system.
Well, the biggest legal crime. It's legal, see. throw that word in. It's legal, the biggest legal crime.
Right, right. And as we've all known, those of us in the know, the worst crimes are those that are legal. The worst criminals are those that make their deeds legal, that become part of the government. If yeah. you can make a crime legal and it's no longer defined as a crime, it doesn't cease to be a crime. It's just been relabeled. People have been led to believe that if you make a statute and you take something morally reprehensible and you give it a legal label, they actually think it changes the nature of the deed. It doesn't change anything.
Mm-hmm.
It just changes. Like, go on.
Yeah, just like carbon is bad, we have to be taxed because we exhale. I mean, it's totally flipped everything upside down. And so most people who are sensible and who are logical and who have, a bit of gumption, they just, they're thrown and they're in confusion. And, of course, that's part of the process.
Yeah, carbon all along has been the gas of life. It has a million and one different benefits, and yet they just relabel it. And then we're supposed to think, well, carbon is suddenly no longer good for us because a politician at the UN or some activist declared it to be bad.
As if 14 saying, years old.
Yeah, as if saying something changes the nature of the atom.
It's again, the cult of personality. They're using the cult of personality to sway the whole population movement. And so then the snitch squad, will snitch on you if you don't agree and comply and you just go and toe the line. And so that's how they entrain us and get us under their control.
Yeah, and I think that for the purposes of time in this relatively brief hour for radio for my show, I'll go ahead and just kind of read. I have the transcript. We won't listen to the tape anymore because they talk a little bit slowly and tentatively. So this important thing we're talking about, the ostensible reason and the real reason, we connected it to abortion and the carbon question. And Dr. Lawrence Dunnigan goes on to say that people don't ask the right questions, too trusting. And this was directed, as I recall, mostly at Americans. This is what Dr. Day said about Americans. They're too trusting. I had the feelings he thought Europeans maybe were more skeptical and more sophisticated, that Americans are too trusting and don't ask the right questions was his key point. And then his interviewer, this lady, Lady Engel here, she says, with regard to the lack of almost a total lack of discernment, I guess that's basically what he was saying. Americans were too easily tricked or too trusting. The thing that flashed through my mind rather quickly, for example, in schools, how soon so-called AIDS education was introduced. It did amaze me because if a group stated publicly that they wanted to introduce the concept of sodomy and initiate sex earlier and earlier in children, and that was the reason given, most parents, presume, wouldn't go for that. So you have to come up with another reason. And of course, the reason for the so-called AIDS education was to protect children from this disease. But actually, as it turns out, it's really been a great boon for the homosexual network, because through various things like Project 10, they now have access to our children from the youngest years. Now, I don't quite understand the full chain of thought there, but she's saying early AIDS education was a surreptitious way to loosen the sodomy laws and make child consent laws for sex more loose and more liberal. We got about 3 minutes left. Your comments?
Well, I think it, you know, again, it's in training the population to familiarize them with things that, you know, before were just absolutely obtuse and obscene and objectionable. But the more you introduce something, the less extreme and the less objectionable it becomes. So it was just another way for them to introduce the concept in mainstream sodomy. You know, it used to be, oh, you know, but now it's accepted as, you know, just a part of what's going on.
Yes, we got about two or three minutes at the most. Exactly. And that seems to be across the board. The real reason versus the ostensible reason. That way, all the little worker bees of society would carry out their part of this, compartmentalized, not realizing what the big scheme was. That's what it seems like to me, because you've got to get everyday people in everyday society to play their small roles at various levels in the power pyramid and in the class system. And so to do that, you have to have these ostensible reasons so people will go along. Well, we need fewer people. We should abort some babies and give women that right, because if we have too many people, it'll threaten the planet. It'll threaten the food supply, right? We'll have overpopulation.
Yeah.
Even though Paul Ehrlich, who wrote The Population Bomb, turned out to be the biggest liar possibly in all of scientific history, and yet the media would still not discredit this absolute charlatan, Paul Ehrlich. Absolute, total, dyed-in-the-wool charlatan, like most scientists these days, I'm sorry to say.
Absolutely, but right. Thank you, Mark.
There's the music, and so those listening live and on the archive, we're going to continue this exploration at least one more time. It'll probably be this coming Wednesday. I want to go over the last part here and retrace our steps on the first two parts a little bit. But thanks for listening, and thanks, Johnny Delirious, for joining me. Your show is on Sundays at 10 a.m., I believe.
Yes, sir.
And your website is johnnydelirious.com. Lots of good nutritional and medical advice there. Thanks, Johnny, and we'll see everybody next time on Stop the Presses.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. September 2018. Extendivite works in keeping my blood pressure in the normal range. I've been using Extendivite for many years now. May 2018. Great product. I use regularly and I rarely get sick. March 2018. This product has relieved what appeared to be angina pain in my chest and shortness of breath after climbing stairs. I'm quite happy about it. February 2018. My husband, son, and I have been using this product for a few months now, and we have noticed an improvement in our joints and blood pressure. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822, or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.